Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a panel discussion titled Europe Confronts Its Past. Speaking will be Martin Šimečka, editor-in-chief of Respekt, a weekly news magazine in the Czech Republic, which reports on domestic and foreign political and economic issues, as well as on science and culture. Also speaking is Igor Lukesh, university professor and professor of international relations and history at Boston University. Tonight's discussion is sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University in cooperation with the Honorary Consulate of the Republic of Slovakia. We begin with an introduction by Peter Muzilla, Honorary Consul of the Republic of Slovakia in Boston.
A couple of months ago, when I approached Elizabeth with the idea of bringing the Magic 8 exhibit to Boston and possibly organizing a small panel discussion for its opening, I remember the first name she mentioned right away as a candidate for the panel was Martin Šimečka. I was familiar with the name, but I never met Martin before this weekend. I knew that he was, for a period of time, editor-in-chief of the SME, the Slovak most influential daily, and that his son of late Milan Šimečka, next to Václav Havel, perhaps the most prominent and widely translated dissident opposing communist regime in Czechoslovakia. Later I learned that Martin was a member of the Czechoslovak underground. His works were not allowed to be published, and the only way he could have been published was in Samizdat or abroad. After 1989, he founded a publishing house, Archa, specializing in books concerning social sciences. His novel, Year of the Frog, was translated to several languages and won numerous prizes. And beside serving as editor-in-chief of SME, he served in the same position in Domino Effect, the Slovak political and cultural weekly. And from 2006, he is an editor-in-chief of Czech weekly Respekt. Martin seemed like a good fit. I said yes. Elizabeth invited him. Martin accepted. Little did we expect that a few days later, both the magazine Respekt and Martin will be quoted in New York Times. For those that might have missed this event, the magazine published an article, an investigative piece, linking perhaps the best-known Czech writer Milan Kundera to a political arrest in 1950. The article steered the whole literary world. Milan Kundera vehemently opposed it, and 11 very well-known writers, including Salman Rushdie, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and three other Nobel laureates, came to his defense. The second panelist is a professor of international relations and history here at BU and a dear colleague of mine in the honorary consular corps in Boston, Mr. Igor Lukesh. Igor, he is a historian of Central Europe in 20th century. He writes about Europe between World Wars. He writes about the contemporary developments in Central East Europe, Russia, and Balkans. When I mentioned his name to Elizabeth, and Elizabeth paid him a visit, I remember the word fabulous, describing a small lecture he gave her on Slovak and Czech history. I have no doubt that he will repeat the feat and he will impress us as he did her. And with this, I will give him the microphone.
Well, I'm of course grateful to my honorable Slovak colleague for his very generous introduction, and I hope not to disappoint. I'm also delighted to share the panel with Martin, whom you already heard about his many achievements, and I want to say that the magazine that he runs in Prague is is truly fabulous, and it also has an English version. It's called Respect, and you can find it on the internet. I am not going to keep you for long. I simply want to look at two distinct topics. The first has to do with the well-known, curious fact that many events in Central Europe, in Central European history, somehow seem to involve the number 8. I can tell you in advance that I looked into it, and I can already now confirm that this curiosity, in fact, is true, and I only will provide some evidence. Then, in the second section, I will look at the way the Central Europeans have tried to deal with their ugly past. Slovaks, Czechs, and others in Central Europe together form an island that is separated from the rest of Europe by various fault lines. Being exposed for centuries to the Russo-Germanic threat has created, I believe, in Central Europe a unique culture, one that contains elements of dark foreboding and resignation, but also humor, determination, and a keen sense that life must continue. I think it was Kundera and Zbigniew Brzeziński who both have suggested that Central Europe is that part of Europe that is best defined by the unity of suffering and laughter, and that it's a part of Europe that somehow fits neatly neither in the Western European nor in the Eastern European context. Regarding the ironies of history that somehow connect Central Europe with the number 8, I only a few hours ago started thinking about it, didn't go into any encyclopedias, and I found that in just from my notes and memory, that in 1278, a Czech king of the Przemyslaj dynasty was defeated just outside Vienna, a huge event that would have important connotations for the geopolitical situation in the region for centuries to come. 100 years later, 1378, Charles IV, probably the most significant of the kings of Bohemia and the Holy Roman Emperor, died. 1428, the Hussites began launching military expeditions, especially in the direction of the German-speaking countries, thus, I think, setting into motion processes that also, for centuries, would influence the region. In 1618, a famous event took place in Prague that essentially amounted to a declaration of war by the Czech estates to the Habsburgs, who joyfully accepted the declaration, launched a military campaign, and defeated the Czechs on the spot, just, I think, 2 years later. This also marked the beginning of the 30 Years' War, which, therefore, ended in 1648, an event that then divided Europe into Protestant and Catholic realms. I'm sure there were many other events, but the next one I remember is 1848, which I think everyone knows as the springtime of nation and the revolutions in Europe, that started with much promise because they initially offered a liberal challenge to conservatism, but soon degenerated into an orgy of nationalism. At least that's the way I perceive them. And unfortunately, one thing called the Communist Manifesto was also published on that year. In 1878, the Congress of Berlin made the huge error and granted administrative responsibilities for Bosnia-Herzegovina to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which thus became involved in a part of Europe where Bismarck had repeatedly warned against getting involved into. Actually the same year, and helpfully on the 18th of December, 1878, None other but Joseph Stalin was born, albeit under a slightly different name at that time. Then in 1908, Austria-Hungary took the fatal step and annexed Bosnia-Herzegovina, thus making it impossible for itself to get out of the region, until on the 28th of June, on 1914, I admit I'm cheating now, Franz Ferdinand and his wife were assassinated in Sarajevo, and a month later, on the 28th of July, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia. Some of the other dates are too familiar for me to bother you with. Obviously, 1918 marked the emergence of sovereign Czechoslovakia. On the 28th of September, 1938, Prime Minister Chamberlain assured Hitler in writing, quote, "You can get everything you want without war." And of course, 2 days later, they signed the Munich Agreement. And then in 1948, we have the communist coup d'etat in Prague. And in 1968, we have the Warsaw Pact invasion of Czechoslovakia, an event that was just recently examined by too many scholarly conferences for me to have any breath left inside my lungs to say anything about it at all, other than it was not scholars or historians who captured the magic of 1968. It was a very short poem by W.H. Auden about ogres. You have read it. It's a brilliant, brilliant thing. The precariousness of living on these fault lines, sandwiched between the German and Russian-speaking realms, I think explains rather well why the main commodity that was always lacking in Central Europe was national security. This, of course, was bad news for the Central Europeans, but it was also bad news for their neighbors, close or distant. After all, the British paid dearly during World War I and World War II. Bismarck observed in 1866 that whoever ruled the territory now occupied by the Czech Republic ruled Europe. Unfortunately, all the major international conferences in the last century either balkanized the part of Europe between Germany and Russia, turning it into a number of small entities, the Versailles system, or simply conferred title to the region to the likes of Hitler, Stalin, and then Brezhnev. The consequences of this are too obvious. In the 20th century, Central Europeans had to endure half a century under two totalitarian regimes, and the West had to deal with the many dangerous twists and turns of the Cold War. Let me move now to my second topic. Unlike in World War II, in which the lines between the good and evil seemed to be clearly drawn, the Cold War was confusing. Although it could have turned violent at a moment's notice, it had remained peaceful most of the time. Ultimately, many had accepted the status quo of divided Europe, almost sort of curiously along the lines of the treaties of Westphalia. And most Western strategists had come to believe that the Red Army's presence in Central Europe was a permanent condition, one that would never be overturned. And this, I think, is why the West did simply nothing to free Central Europe from the clutches of the Soviet Union, and more importantly, why it was so disoriented and confused for much of the 1990s when its opponents had melted away. No one in the West celebrated the end of the Cold War. And I think this in itself was very peculiar. I know that I have now abused that word too much in this short time, but peculiar is the only word that comes to mind. When a war ends, there is often much celebrating. Consider the massive kissing that's immortalized in that beautiful photograph from Park Avenue, New York, where a sailor is kissing an army nurse on the day Japan surrendered. But together, remember, of course, all the military parades that took place, of course, everywhere in this country, and famously in London, where all those, minus Poland, who participated in the great victory over Nazism, could march. But together with the kissing and hugging and marching and general celebrating also came the Nuremberg trials and the hangings and clear statements by the Allies to the effect that Nazism was a criminal doctrine. It's important to remember that the denazification was carried out and supervised not by the German people, but by the outsiders, especially by the Americans. It was the Americans who decided who was going to remain a police officer, who was going to remain a prison guard, a judge, a kindergarten teacher, a college professor, a journalist, or an official in the state banking system. It was the American officials who carried out these cleansings or purges or whatever one wants to call it. All professions in post-war Germany were very closely scrutinized, and again, by the outsiders. In addition to Germany, many European countries dealt severely with acts against national honor, as they preferred calling collaboration, even if it meant adopting retroactively dubious laws. For instance, France imposed after the war 6,763 death penalties on its own citizens, on top of about 9,000 extrajudicial killings on the street. It sent 40,000 collaborators to prison. In Belgium, 2,940 were executed and 53,000 were sent to prison. In the Netherlands, not a country one associates with harshness, 152 were executed for collaboration and 49,000 were sent to prison. As I already hinted, I think some of these procedures were questionable ethically, perhaps even legally. But there was a general consensus that such measures were necessary for Europe to leave the ugly past behind. And in a short time, denazification combined with the Marshall Plan produced stable and prosperous regimes that soon enjoyed miraculous economic development and have remained stable to this day. The Third Reich was, of course, a totalitarian regime where one could reasonably well discern the line between the jailers and the inmates, between those who held power and those who did not. Power was in the hands of an elite that never hid its existence and certainly did not deny its existence. Yet, I think, had the German people been left to their own devices in 45, 46, 47, 48, I doubt very much that they would have had the inner strength to carry out the kind of massive purge of the Nazi evil that was necessary. Consider further that Hitler ruled for only 12 years and that there were some 80 million citizens in the Third Reich. And for those 80 million citizens, the Gestapo had, at the height of its power, about 40,000 officials. In other words, there was roughly one agent for every 2,000 German citizens. By contrast, communism in Central Europe had lasted almost half a century. The security apparatus were much bigger and had much more time at their disposal. For instance, in East Germany, a country of some 17 million people, the security apparat, the Stasi, had 102,000 officials who relied on permanent assistance from 300,000 informers. In other words, there was roughly one Stasi agent for every 40 citizens in the East German regime, in contrast to the 2,000 in the Third Reich. Importantly, the communist countries in Central Europe evolved into what Havel, I think, in a very brilliant essay, called the post-totalitarian regimes, where it was no longer possible, or certainly it was no longer easy, to discern the difference between the jailer and the inmate, because in those much more complicated regimes, everyone, as Havel argued, was simultaneously a jailer and an inmate, because power found its outpost inside everyone's soul. These were the reasons, I think, why the West in 89, 90, 91 should have offered help to the Central Europeans as they began thinking and reflecting about their ugly past. But the opposite happened. The West, from the beginning, firmly discouraged any attempt to examine the crimes of the communist era. Washington advanced the view quite forcefully that one should simply draw a thick line somewhere in November 1989 and move ahead. And it applauded the countries that chose to do nothing in the early 1990s, and it actively discouraged and even ostracized countries who tried to do something. Countries such as Germany, for instance, and Czechoslovakia, which passed its lustration laws. Now, to be fair, many people in Central Europe objected to lustrations. Adam Michnik, a man I immensely admire, warned right from the start that revolutions which start with attacks on prisons are destined to build new ones. And Václav Havel, whom I already quoted, also discouraged wallowing in the past and pointed out that since everyone was part of the old regime, since everyone carried some degree of responsibility for the crimes of the old regime, any attempts at somehow attaching a degree of guilt on particular individuals was only going to put egg on the perjurer's face. We're all guilty, he said more than once, implying, of course, that if all were guilty, then nobody was. The CIA also embraced this view. A high official of the agency soon in the 1990s co-authored a book with a general of the KGB, and many former agents and officials of the intelligence services from the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe found themselves in America, wined and dined by their former opponents. I think the consequences of this can be seen everywhere in the region. For instance, in Poland, it was revealed relatively recently, the security apparat was able to place its informers near the very top of the Catholic Church. A brilliant Catholic journalist who was for years regarded as a kind of a guiding person, as a sort of a guiding light in matters of ethics and general morality, it was now revealed was on the payroll of the secret police. It turned out that a friend of Father Popieluszko, who was murdered by the security services, another priest was an informer for the security apparat, as was a close friend of the Pope. Of course, the cases of Lech Wałęsa and his successor in the office of President of Poland, Aleksander Kwaśniewski, are well known, as Agent Bolek, I think, was the case with Mr. Wałęsa and Alek, which was President Kwaśniewski's code name. When this was revealed, the public responded with a large-scale assault not on the informers, but who, after all, had at a minimum betrayed the trust of their friends, but on the historians who had uncovered these documents. A similar situation developed in Hungary. István Szabó, a well-known movie director, I think Oscar-winning, if I'm not mistaken, and highly regarded for movies such as Mephisto, Colonel Redl, Sunshine, and I'm sure several others, it turned out, reported on his fellow students in the Film Academy. When this was revealed, more than 100 Hungarian intellectuals produced a petition, sort of very emotionally formulated petition, in which they again attacked those who came up with this revelation and defended the director as somebody who has spread the good name of Hungary, the fame of Hungary, to all parts of the world. The public reacted in a similar way when the Archbishop of Budapest was revealed to have been a police informer, or when it turned out that a pillar of one of the most respected aristocratic families in all of Hungary's history had been the author of, quote, hundreds upon hundreds of handwritten notes in which he, for the security services, identified individuals, some of whom were simple kids, villagers, for crimes which were punishable by death. For instance, involvement in the revolution of 1956. And whoever could be proven to have carried a weapon was automatically under a death sentence. This particular man's son wrote a moving book about his father in which he celebrated him. And then somehow, having finished the book, he only then went to the security archives and discovered that there were boxes of materials that in fact produced an entirely different perspective on his father. He wrote an additional volume in which he made these documents public. What was more interesting than this, because this is but one banal story out of a thousand, what was more interesting that yet again the public proved to be much more tolerant of the old gentleman than his loving son, who in fact comes across as somebody who is quite critical, who expresses a sense of shame and betrayal. And yet the public completely dismissed this and said, don't touch our hero. Finally, in Prague, as you already heard from my Slovak colleague, a researcher came upon a document indicating that a well-known writer, Milan Kundera, on one occasion informed the communist police. The public reaction followed the very same pattern that I already described for Poland and Hungary. Namely, it attacked the researcher, the bearer of the bad news, not the person who caused the outrage. And as Peter already indicated, some 10 or 11 Nobel Prize winners stood up to defend their colleague without having any understanding of the document that's involved and the case and the facts They simply didn't need to know that because he is their colleague, he is their hero. Therefore, by definition, he is noble and ethical. In conclusion, I think this indicates many different things, and I'm delighted to discuss them with you afterwards. But I would just say that I think at a minimum it shows that the Cold War somehow fizzled out, leaving behind very few physical traces. If you go to today's Berlin, it is nearly impossible to see where the Berlin Wall, which was a massive construction, once stood. It is so carefully erased from the physical layout of the city. But the Cold War, although it left few physical objects behind, it left many existential concerns. And the prominent one is fear. Fear, of course, is an integral component of the human condition. We all fear something. Some of us fear love, some of us fear flying, some of us fear middle age, some of us fear freedom. I think the Central Europeans have come out of the Cold War fearing their past. Thank you very much.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's not easy now to continue about the past, the topic Mr. Lukács has now opened. I can only add that, talking about agents in my surrounding from the past, my closest friend proved to be an agent who was a leader of Slovak Revolution, Jan Buda, if may you have heard about this name, and some other friends who, during this period after 89, showed to be agent, and in the agent illustration, their names came up. It wasn't easy to deal with that, and I think Professor is right. The biggest fear in societies of Central Europe is a fear from the past. But I'll try to talk about more about presence or the past, which is not so dirty and which is not so much to fear. It's a past very close. It's a past of last 20 years in Slovakia. But Slovakia is... we have to start with a split of Czechoslovakia, talking about Slovakia, because it was the first time, actually, when the Slovak state became independent in a way which it should not be shamed of, as it was, in, for example, from this period of 39 to 45. Slovaks, actually, in that 92, the majority of Slovaks didn't want their own state, and it's quite an unusual situation when you have a nation which dream about the statehood actually wasn't very strong. There was a dream about a better relationship with one state of Czechoslovakia and more sovereignty inside the state. But we can't talk about the battle for independence. And there is an irony of history that actually, Slovak state, as we know now, was given more by Czechs than by Slovaks themselves. And in 92, there was a deep debate between Slovak part of federation and Czechs. And when Prime Minister Václav Klaus, as a very excited reformist to the new capitalism of Central European states, understood that Slovaks were not so, they were much more reluctant to make transformational reforms, and they also have some kind of demands of more rights for the in that federation. So he said, well, okay, that's fine, let's split. And so it was more from Czech side, the pressure on the split of federation than from Slovak one, which is, of course, mostly it is discussed and explained like Slovaks has won their own independence. The fact is that it was a surprise for Slovak themselves, even when the January 93, they just everybody from us woke up in that morning and we were just in independent state, which was for many people quite a shock. Again, to be honest, to say, my position in that time was I was very deeply against that split. I believed that for Slovak future it's better to stay with Czechs. I didn't believe very much in Slovak idea of state and in Slovak ability to rule a state, mostly because if there were politicians who declared their will to build an independent state, they were a marginal nationalistic party, which one could be feared of that this had not very much to do with the democracy. They spoke about national sovereignty, but not about democracy. And so the reason why I was also against the split was that I was afraid that the regime in the new state would not be democratic, and it proved I was right in the first years of that. But again, to say this, it's also good to say that 15 years later, I have to say that this solution, although it wasn't in my taste, probably was the best one, because the relationship between Czechs and Slovaks today is much more better than it had ever been in the past. And although conditions for the split were not the best, the result is quite good. So this does not mean that I should apologize for those nationalists to those nationalists, but I have to admit that this way, and Slovak independence has proved that Slovakia was able to run its state, and actually it's quite successful. But it wasn't from the beginning like that. And I come to the year, which is not written there, it's another magic eight, and it's 1998. I think that this year, actually, for Slovakia, is the most important year in their history for various reasons. The first, this was a year when the elections, the opposition against the first years of Slovak government, which was under Mr. Vladimir Mečiar, whom you know maybe the name, in that first years from 92 to 98, actually was established a kind of regime which was not very democratic. It's more or less postmodern authoritarian regime, very, very strange one, where some political murder had happened, when the kidnapping of President's son happened, where the media were not free, where even the economical transformation was just in a half of its way. Banks were still state, in the hands of state. The privatization itself, the big companies were privatized into the friends of the government. And political idea was based on the much, very much nationalistic ideology. And there was a time when Slovakia became a problematic country of Central Europe, and in time when Madeleine Albright has said that this is a black hole of Central Europe about Slovakia, where there were deep doubts about what the way of Slovakia of the future would be, when Mr. Mečiar has said that, talking about foreign policy, if the Western Europe doesn't want us, so we turn to the East, which meant Russia. It was a time where it was a deep doubt about the Slovak future in Central Europe, a future of the democratic state, which should belong to the Western Europe. What happened in 98, and that's why I think it's so important date, is that in elections, and before them, mostly before them, it happened that not only political opposition, but the big part of the society, led by young people and NGOs, organized a huge campaign which should turn the history, it should change the system to elect the democratic opposition in that time. The result of the elections is due to their activity. When they make people to come to the elections, about 80% of people came to the elections. And the model of activism for democratic values could change the system by elections. And this was the first time, actually, if we don't talk about 1944 when it was a Slovak uprising against Hitler's army, this was the first time when Slovak nation actually organized itself or part of the society and had energy to change the system and prepare the country for the better future. You may say that maybe the 89 would be more important data, but I have to admit that being a part of that 89, I have to say that comparing it to 98, in 89 the Slovaks were, of course, I admire the courage of people who were in the first day of, well, the revolution, participants on that. For me it wasn't so difficult because I was a dissident, for me it wasn't a kind of new experience, but there were many people who had reasons to be afraid, but they had courage to come to the street and squares and organize the demonstrations. But beside that, we have to say that it wasn't actually the original act. It was the act which followed what happened in Prague. The fact is that it were not Slovaks who started the revolution, it were Czechs. I mean, this is just a fact. But in 98, they were Slovak themselves. They were those in their own nation, without any help from outside, had been able to change the country for the better future. But having said that, it still does not mean that Slovakia is the nation which is, I would say, convinced about the idea what actually is this state good for. Why and how should this state we should build? What is the idea of that? How the society should behave? What are the values we should share together? The society is divided, as it used to be for a long time. The years after 98 were probably the best years of the country and of the nation because they discovered at least one idea that small nation in Central Europe can have. And the idea was, well, we are not a big nation, we are just 5 million people. We are the nation without a real famous history. It's more or less the history which we shared with the others, either Hungarians or Czechs. It's not the history you can really be proud of very much as a history of our own nation. It was a history of the desire more than a real fact. But in these late 19th and the years after 98, the political representation decided, well, if we haven't a very big past, we can do something for our future and for the present. And the idea was to change or to make a challenge for the society and to try to be modern, reformed, transformed democracy and successful state. The idea was more or less economics, but it was extremely successful. And Slovaks can be proud on that, that the reforms that next government has made were admired, and not only Central Europe. And the result of that is that Slovakia, which was in the all past, well, recognized as more or less, I mean, much less developed country than the region around, just in a few years became a state with a very successful economics, with a very 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 fast growth, which last year was 10%, and even maybe this year we will be maybe 5, which is, comparing the recession all around almost, is quite admirable. And I'm talking about that this is the idea that a small nation can have if it has an opportunity and the energy which was fulfilled by this event in 98 when the society became self-confident because they proved itself that they are able to change, that they are able to face the new challenges. Again, saying this, it does not mean that everything is so fine. Slovakia has many problems, and in that exhibition you can read that part of our history, a very complicated one, is our relationship to Hungary, or because you used to be a part of the Hungarian Empire. And it's just recently that, the quarrel, or I would say very big tension between Hungary and Slovakia is just now, even the European Union and Brussels. It happened just a couple of weeks ago that there was some football game, I mean soccer game in America, we are in America, in a Slovak part where Slovak soccer team played against another Slovak soccer team, but the Slovak soccer team which was in a town where Hungarian minority lives. Some rowdies or skinheads from Hungary, not some, but I mean hundreds of them, came to this town to provoke. They were beaten by Slovak police. Immediately, Hungarian government made a note that the Slovak police decided to beat only Hungarians, not the Slovaks. Then it was followed by other events, which are many now to describe. But this is just an example of how very aggressive statements from both sides across the border were changing the notes from diplomats' notes and statements from prime ministers from both Slovak and Hungarian side, blaming Slovakia's Slovak government for a nationalistic coalition, which is right on the other hand. There is a Slovak National Party, a coalition partner of the government, which is very nationalistic, and that's true. On the other hand, in Hungary, you have an organization which are, by definition, fascistic, and they wear uniforms, and with these uniforms reminding fascistic state or fascistic past in 40s, they walked across the border to Slovakia on these uniforms, which is provocative in a way. Well, I can't imagine how can you provoke Americans in such a way like this could work in Slovakia. So the problem of Slovaks now and Slovakia itself is that the economical success is without any debate, but the political success has still time to come. There is a problem that Slovakia and Slovak government, especially today, is not able to somehow to deal with that problem that it has 600,000 Hungarians living on its territory as a minority. And on the other side, the Hungary itself is not able to adapt on the situation that this Hungarian minority living in Slovakia will be living there for probably forever. And they have to just deal with that somehow. What I wanted to say is that Slovakia is a small state with some kind of successes and some kind of future, which is now, after being a member of the European Union and NATO, the future is quite, I would say, good, or at least it seems to be. It does not mean that this country developed enough or adult enough to accept some political challenges. And Central Europe will have a problem with this. And we probably are facing times which may be difficult because the political coincidence speaks that will be elections in Central Europe almost at the same time. In Slovakia, probably the government which is now in power probably will continue, but in Hungary will come to the power today's opposition, which is much more nationalistic than the government of today in Hungary. So the tension we can expect, which will be much, much stronger than it is today. And the voice in Central Europe after having elections in Austria, where the ultra-right wing parties received 30% of votes. Where in Czech Republic you can see quite a difficult situation. That Central Europe will be maybe not forever. Until last these years, it seemed to be a kind of a peaceful region. Maybe it's not so sure. And that, of course, is a challenge for all nations. And I think that Slovakia is not quite well prepared for that. I hope I'm not right. And I don't want to be pessimistic about the future. But the fact that we are members of the European Union doesn't mean that our future is only bright and without any problems. And the sooner our politicians will understand that, the better for all of us. So thank you very much. I mean, this is not about past, it's about future. When I finished, of course I'm prepared to talk about the past as Mr. Professor, opened the topics.
Thank you so much for your attention. And,
for coming. This is WBUR. You've been listening to a panel discussion titled Europe Confronts Its Past. Our speakers were Martin Šimečka, editor-in-chief of the Czech weekly news magazine Respekt, and Boston University professor of international relations and history, Igor Lukeš. We began with an introduction by Peter Muzilla, honorary consul of the Republic of Slovakia in Boston. Tonight's discussion was sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University in cooperation with the Honorary Consulate of the Republic of Slovakia. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Jared Mooney with help from Edward Mazulis. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.